All right, we're beginning here, eight lines down on the top of Samachem with Aleph. The Gemara is continuing with a similar story that we saw yesterday with regards to the sending of a gift to someone, the Yom Edam, and the statement by Rav Yehuda, there's no problem because I know he's not a worshiper of Avodah Zarah. We have a similar story with Rava, which is Rava Matile Kurbana the Bar Sheshach the Yom Edam. He sent a gift to Bar Sheshach on their holiday. Amar Yedanabed Lo Palach Lovodat Kochavim. I know that he doesn't worship Avodah Zarah, and then all that we discussed in the previous case is also applicable over here, because of the fact that he knew he wasn't worshiping Avodah Zarah, sending the gift was not going to have the implications that we saw in the Daf Bet of the Masechta, which is he's not going to thank his Avodah Zarah for getting the gift, he's not going to use it as a Tikrovet Avodah Zarah, so all those worries disappear if he's not a worshiper of Avodah Zarah, and again we discussed that this is one of the main bases for the sack of the Baalei HaTosafot, that the Goyim today may not have the status of Uvdei Avodah Zarah, and if that's the case, then the restrictions that are mentioned earlier on in the Masechta may not have application. We saw that in Rashi, in the Baalei HaTosafot, the Rambam brings it with regards to the Muslims as well. So this has very big implications in terms of how we deal today with these issues. Azal Ashkechei Deyativ Atzavarei Bevarda. So he went to visit him, Rabbi went to visit Bar Sheshach, and he saw that he was in the bathhouse, in the spa, that he was in a merchatz shovradim. He was in a rose bath, rekaimin zonot arumot kamei, and all these naked harlots surrounding him. Amar lei, so now Bar Sheshach says to Rabbi when he comes, idluchu ki gaya avna le'alam da'ati? Do you have anything like this in your world to come? Meaning that this is the ultimate. There's no way that you have anything better than this. Amalei, didana difa tve mihai. Rabbi said, back then we got something better than that. Amalei, tve mihai mihava. There's nothing better than this. There's no way you have anything better than this. Amalei, atu niko alaihu emta de malchuta. You still have the fear of the king that is over you. Ana no tehevi alan emta de malchuta. We won't have that experience of the emata malchuta didabo. Now, it could be that this is a veiled reference to the position of Shmuel, which we saw in Perek Achelek, and we see it other places in Shas, that ein bein olam hazeh lemot haMashiach el shibud malchiot bilvad, that the only difference between today and then in the time of Mashiach will be the lack of shibud malchiot, that we won't have to worry about the authority of the other nations, and that's what the reference to here is, that we won't have emta de malchuta like you have emta de malchuta. Although that seems to be too small an item, and I don't think it seems to be what he's referencing to, especially because he's speaking about l'olam ha'ate, which is olam haba. Therefore, it's likely that we won't have emta de malchuta is because latid lavol, as it says at the end of the Gemara in Ta'anit, that the tzaddikim will be sitting around a kodesh baruch hu b'nenenim miziv ha'shechina, and that they are basking in the glory of a kodesh baruch hu. And there won't be this emta de malchuta that is chasing after you. Rather, you're going to be enjoying and basking in the glory of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So it's a much more positive experience, which is that you're freed of the burdens of this world and the authorities of this world. So Amalei, ana miha, my emta de malchuta ikalai. So Bar Sheshach says to Rava, I don't have any fear of the king on me. I don't have any of these problems. So what are you talking about? How could it be better for you if I don't even have it right now? So, adiyatve, and before they got up, or before this ended, ata hao priskita de malko, all of a sudden a messenger of the king showed up. Amalekum kabailach malko. The king wants you, you better get up right now. Now, Bar Sheshach was probably referencing, it's this story is with Rava, so it's in Bavel. First of all, you see that Rava had a good relationship with the ruler at that time, and that they did have good political connections. Rava was known as one of the leading Talmidei Chachamim. We know he was in the city of Mechuza, which was a very wealthy city. And here he has a connection to Bar Sheshach. So that's number one. Number two is the fact that the Persian rulership in general was a loose confederation, which is that each regional person had a lot of autonomy, and there was a king over them. That was true during many of the different ruling periods of Persia, that it was more of a loose confederation rather than what was by Rome, where the Caesar or the monarch ruled over everybody. And again, there were regional authorities, but there was much more connection to this center in Rome. Whereas here in Persia, they intentionally ruled with looser hand, allowing the local regional people more freedom in their rule. And that's why Be'er Sheshach was saying, I don't have any Imta de Malchuta on me. And then just to prove that he's wrong about that, right, as he says that, there gets a message from the king, you better show up. And obviously, when the king asks you to show up, you show up. Kinofik, the Azil. So when he was on his way out, they're dragging him out of his bath with the Zonot. Amalei, Eina, Dabai, the Mechze, Luchu, Bishuta, Tifka. So he gives, as Rashi says over here, a compliment to the Jews. He says that anybody who is looking out for the detriment of the Jews, his eyes should burst or his eyes should fall out. And that he sees in this idea that a shliach shows up just as Rava tells him this thing, that you Jews, of course, Baruch Hu looks out for you and takes care of you. And therefore, he gives them a bracha that anybody who's looking to hurt you or to your detriment should be hurt. Samalei Rava, amen. Rava says, amen, you're right. That's a great bracha. We'll take that bracha. Pakeina, the Be'er Sheshach. Guess what happens? Bar Sheshach on his way out loses an eye. Underlying that is indicative of the fact that his bracha was really just a surface false type of statement, and that he himself was not necessarily positively inclined to the Jews, and he was a little upset, maybe even speaking sarcastically to Rava about the fact that just as Rava said this, the king's messenger shows up and drags him out of his bath, and he says, anybody wants to think bad about you guys should be hurt, and sure enough, he's the one who's thinking exactly that way, and he loses an eye. Amar Rav Papi. He bailed the memra le mehaikra. So Rav Papi says, why didn't Rava respond to him in a more direct manner and give him a posuk that would indicate the difference between what Bar Sheshach, the Persian ruler, was experiencing and what Rava was describing about Olam Haba? Should have quoted them the posuk from Tehillim, which is speaking about Latid Lavo. Binot milachim bikrotecha. So the princesses will be, the way that the Balei Tosafot bring, based on Rashi and Tehillim, Bikrotecha means visitors, or those that come in your presence. Although Rashi over here says Bikrotecha means Lechvod Yisrael, Yakar, in the honor of Klal Yisrael. Nitzva Shegal Limincha, the queen will be standing or in position to your right. Beketem Ophir, and she will be bedecked in golden jewelry of Ophir. So here you have a description of the Latid Lavo, that they will be princesses and the queens will be accompanying you or around you. And so it seems to be what Rav Papi was indicating is, here Be'er Sheshach is talking about he's surrounded by these naked zonot, but in the end they are zonot. They are harlots. Not exactly your most honorable people to be around you. And over here it's describing what's going to be for the Jews, and it's being about the princesses and the queens that are going to surround them, which is much more honorable in its description. And that was the contrast between what Be'er Sheshach was experiencing and what will be Latid Lavo. He should have used this pasuk. Again, this is a pasuk that we brought up numerous times in Perka Chilek, which is Ayin Lorata Elukim Zulatcha Yaseh Limechakelo. No eye has seen besides you, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, what you will do for those that wait, or those that will garner the rewards in the future. And the Gemara in Achilek said this reference to Olam Haba, and specifically the Gemara there speaks about the fact that all the Nevi'im, when they were predictive in nature, when they spoke about the future, they were speaking about Yemot HaMashiach. They were not speaking about Olam Haba, and because Olam Haba is Ayin Lo Ra'ata, nobody has seen it yet. And it's beyond human comprehension how good Olam Haba is. And that's the pasuk that he should have quoted to Bar Sheshach. You can see here on the side that there was an alternative girsa, which is he should have answered him from here, Ul'om me'om yematz, that the younger one or the downtrodden one will then rise up and be the ruler. So there is an additional view here of quoting that pasuk, which references to the fact that Bnei Yisrael will arise and then they will be on top. So just because you're on top now doesn't mean that Bnei Yisrael won't switch places and be on top afterwards. The reason it likely it's not included in the Girsa is because that's a reference to Esav. That's really a reference as the Gemara views the descendants of Esav being Rome and not being the Persian rulers. And therefore maybe they felt there wasn't the right pasuk or the appropriate pasuk for the story that's here. Aside from the fact that Rava couldn't quote these psukim in the place that he was, Rava obviously felt that quoting psukim was not going to do the trick for Bar Sheshach. it wasn't exactly what he was looking for in terms of understanding what Olam Haba is. He had to give him a concrete example of what's going to be the difference. And that's why he spoke about Imta de Malchuta, because for Basheshach, there was nothing above him except that one item. There was one thing that could make his life miserable or force him to act not of his own volition, and that would be the Imta de Malchuta. And that's what Rava was trying to prove to him, that as free as you feel and as good as you feel, you still have something that chains you down or causes you agmat nefesh, and therefore you don't have that ultimate feeling of freedom and the experience of goodness. And again, even though Rava could have given other answers, he gave something that Bar Sheshach himself could understand. If he hired him to do other work. So this is the second part of the Mishnah. First part of the Mishnah, if he's a poel that is working with the Ayin Nesech, then his salary is docked or is a asur be'ana'ah. Here, where he's hired to do other things. And as part of that, he also ends up working with the Yayin Nesech. There, the Mishnah said it's mutar, it's not a problem. Is that true? Even though he didn't speak to him in the nightfall or as night began? Lutute Erev means in the evening time. And Rashi takes that very literally. He's reached the end of his day's work. He's finished what he should get paid for. And now he asks him, you know what, can you do me a favor? Can you just move this item? Can you take this item? What the Gemara is implying is, I could understand the Mishnah if the case in the Mishnah is that he earned his salary, and then he asked him to do this one extra thing for him, which is carry this chavit, shel yayin. In the end, he does that, but that's not part of his payment, and that's why there's no problem. But the Mishnah never qualifies it. And that's what the Gemara is asking. Even though he did specify that this happened after he had completed his salary, implying that it might have happened in the middle of the day. And this is part of what he's working for and part of the salary that he's receiving. How can you do that? Verimini. We have a bright and a tosefta. Socherita puel. He hires a worker. Ulitute erev. So this is where the Gemara got the term from, which is at nightfall or at the end of his day. Amarlo, hever chavitsha yainesech mi makom le makom. Please take this barrel of yainesech from place to place. Scharo mutar. Then his wages from the daytime are fine because he did this in his after hours. It wasn't part of his day work. Taima damale lutute erev in makes it sound like the only reason it's mutar is because he asked him to do this after he had completed his day's work. Kulayoma alo. But if he did it any other time during the day, that would cause a problem because then it would be a part and parcel of his salary was garnered through working with Isurei Hana'ah. And that would present the same problem that we have in the first part of the Mishnah, which is if you earn your money for working with these Yai Nesech, it is problematic. So now, Amar Abaye, ki tanan nami matznitin, in our Mishnah it is, Amar li tute erev tanan. Just assume that that's what's happening in our Mishnah. Our Mishnah doesn't explicate on it, but our Mishnah, obviously, to be reconciled with this Tosefta, meant that when he says to them, can you move that stuff, it meant at the end of the day. It didn't mean as part of his work, but rather at the end of the day. And it's as if it says, Lutute Erev, in our Mishnah. Rav Amar Lo Kasha, Rav says, no, you don't have to amend the Mishnah or imply something in the Mishnah, but rather there's a difference between the Mishnah and the Tosefta. Had Amar Lei, Haver Li Mea Chaviot, Be Mea Brutot. The Breiter, the Tosefta, is a case where he says to him, I want you to move 100 barrels for 100 Brutot. Ha? Our Mishnah is, Amar Lei, Haver Li Chavit Chavit Be Brutot. Please take each chavit, and every chavit that you move, I'll give you a pruta. So in our Mishnah, there's a direct correlation between each barrel that he moves and the pruta that he receives. So if he moves 100 barrels, he'll get 100 prutot. Moves 101 barrels, he'll get 101 prutot. But in that case, each barrel is an independent salary or an independent wage that he earns. That means that if within those barrels he moves chaviot, shel yayin nesech, all he has to do is take that salary that were associated with those barrels and destroy it, dispose of it, or not take payment from the individual when he moves those barrels. But he can segregate the wages that were fine and were earned from barrels that were fine and wages that came from the illicit profits of working with the Yayin Nesech. And that way he can deal with the issue of the Yayin Nesech. On the other hand, in the Tosefta, where he says it's 100 barrels for 100 zuz, over there, he only gets paid if he moves the full 100. There's a job to be done, and he has to complete the job. amongst those barrels is the barrel of Yayin Nesach. If he doesn't move that barrel of Yayin Nesach, he's not getting paid. So he has to move the barrel of Yayin Nesach in order to get paid the 100 zuz. Now, even though the 100 zuz equals the 100 barrels, and that means technically it's one zuz per barrel, but nevertheless, he aggregated them into a single salary and said, you get 100 for 100. But that means you got to move the 100, and if you have to move a Yayin Nesach to get there, that means it's integral to the fact that you're going to get paid this salary. And that means that the salary is tainted because of the fact that the Yayin Nesach was a part and parcel of that which you garnered. Va'atanyo. And the Gemara brings a bright of inichuta in support of Rava's contention here, which is a socher tepuel. Va'amalo heverli mea chaviot b'mea putot. He says to him, listen, can you move 100 barrels for 100 zuz? Nitzeit chavit shel Yayin Nesach b'nehem. If amongst those barrels is a barrel of Yayin Nesach, scharo asur, then the scar is problematic because it was necessary to move that Yayin Nesach in order to get his wages. Chavit, chavit bepruta, if it's done with a specific amount per barrel, then each barrel stands independently and each barrel earns him a wage independently. Nitzit chavit shel Yayin Nesach b'nehem, scharo mutar. In that case, the scar, X, the scar from the Yayin Nesach will be mutar, because each one of them independently earned a prutai, was not an aggregated salary. Now, the Balia Tosafot ask over here, there are other ways to deal with this problem, and why didn't the Gemara at least attempt to use those as the possible answers? One of them is Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, who we're going to learn about upcoming in the Gemara, we also quoted him earlier on in the Masechta, believes that when you have a problem that involves a tarovet, a mixture of Yayin Nesach and other items, that you can sell off the item X, the value of the Yayin Nesach that is in there. The Hadalo Mishani, that's what it says, Matnit and Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. Just say our Mishnah is authored by Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. Damar Yimacher Kulo Chutz Midmei Yayin Nesach. Just sell off everything X, the value of the Yayin Nesach, which means it's the same thing here. He could keep his salary X, the value that is associated with the Yayin Nesach. And that should have worked just fine over here. Why doesn't the Gemara use that as the answer? So he brings a number of answers. He also quotes the possibility of setting it up like Rabbi Eliezer, who also has an opinion that you can redeem the Avodah Zarah. We could use either one of those to author our Mishnah and not have a problem. So the Tosafot in the end basically says, that the Gemara wants to get the Mishnah to fit in the Shita of the Rabbanan, not just in the Shita of Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. Or, he suggests over here, Inami Baha, Afila Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel Modi. And in our case here, even Rabbi Shimon Gamliel will admit or agree with the position of the Chachamim, because he says, over there, it's not normal to buy wine from the Oved Kochavim. Since it's not the normal way to do it, we allowed you to deal with the issue and sell it off, and then get rid of the problem part of it. On the other hand, it is a normal process for people to take wages from an Oved Kochavim. And therefore, it makes sense to be Oser all the Schar in order to distance people from the problem. In the case where the Yayin Nesach gets mixed up with your wine, you're trying to deal with a problem after the fact. Again, a problem that in general we avoid, and a situation where we're not normally transacting. So in that case, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel gives you a dispensation to deal with the issue. Over here, where this is normal course of business, which is that you're hired by the Oved Kochavim, if you want to dissuade people from taking salary for a Yayin Nesach, or indicate to them that there's a problem, if you allow them to do this and just exclude that part of the salary, they're not really going to be so careful about it. And then maybe even Rabbi Shimon Gamliel agrees that you don't have such a dispensation to dispose of it, X the Yayin Nesach that is there. That's the way the Balei Tosafot deals with reason why the Gemara didn't approach this in a different way or use the answer that there are Tanaim that could easily be the authors of this Mishnah. That's because either they want to set it up like the Rabbanan, or that in this case, even those that say that it's normally Mutar would make it a Sur, because we don't want people engaging in this type of behavior. Now the Balei Tosafot, Rashi over here explains that the way that it works, or when it's permissible, when he says to them, listen, you can have 100 barrels for 100 zuz, then le'utute erev, if he then after hours asks him to go ahead and do some extra work, then his salary is mutar. Now from Rashi, it sounds like he's doing it gratis. He's doing it for free. The guy just asks him a favor, can you move the barrel? What the Balei Tosafot say is that that's not necessarily true. They think that even if he gets paid for that, it still doesn't create a problem. After he finished his contract work, was to move 100 barrels for 100 zuz. He does that. Then he says, can you do me a favor? Can you move these couple extra barrels? They turn out to be Yain Nesech, and he ends up paying him the same salary or the same rate that he was getting for the contract, which means he gives him 3 zuz for those 3 extra barrels. So now you might have thought that that then gets aggregated with the total salary, the 100 plus the 3, because it was under the same terms. And so maybe that's a sort, that's the Kamash Malon, that it's not problematic because it's after his contracted amount was already garnered. So the Baliyat would say there's even a bigger Kiddush here. Rashi just says he does it gratis afterwards, it's not a problem. Because even if you get paid for it afterwards, and you get paid for it under the same terms of the original contract, since you finished your contracted work, and you got paid for it, you could have gotten paid for it, that's not a problem then to add on those at the end. You have to throw out that money, you can't take that salary, but it won't taint the salary before. And so that's what the Chiddush of the Tuta Erev is, the Mishnah, where it's one for one, there's no problem at all. In the Tosefta, where it's an aggregate amount for the aggregate barrels, there's a problem. But there, even there, if you do it after hours, after you finish your contracted work, it's also permissible. There are those, like the Rashba over here, that ask the question of, don't we have a principle when it comes to salaried workers, schirut? There's a machloket as to whether ain't schirut ala basof, that person only earns their wages as a hired laborer at the end of their work, or as yesh schirut mitchila v'adsof, or are they earning it on an incremental basis as they work, they're earning their salary towards the total amount that's given. The Rashba says that we paskin that there is schirut mitchila v'adsof. If that's the case, then each part of the work that you do independently earns you the salary. And so why over here is there a problem? Even if you have the salary aggregated as 100 zuz for the 100 barrels, it still should be mutar, because you could still disaggregate the salary into the time period that he's working. And therefore over here it should be mutar as well. Why is it that it's asur? So the truth is that if you look carefully in the Baliyat Tosafot, he may not have the problem, because the Baliyat Tosafot called it, says, Shishlim Kablanuto. He says that he's not a sakhir. He's not considered to be a laborer or a hired hand. He's considered to be a contractor. And then a contractor, it's totally different. A contractor gets paid when he completes the work that he's contracted for. So there's no issue of skirut mitchila adsof. Here it's kablanut. But according to the Rashba, where he does think it is skirut, he wants to know, why is it that over here there's no disaggregation of the earnings, and therefore you should be able to make it mutar by just pulling out the issue of the Yayin Nesech. So he says that there is a difference between this case and a case that we saw earlier in the Masechta. That's when he's building the bathhouse. And when he builds the bathhouse, they also put up an area where they stand the Avodah Zarah, or there are areas that are problematic. And the Gemara over there says that when he does the part that's Asur, or when it's finished, is Makush Acharon, is the last hammer. And over there, that value is not worth a Shave Pruta. So even though there is a point where it reaches the point of Isur, that point of Isur is at the end, and it's too small to be classified as something big enough to taint his whole salary. So what the Rashba says over here implied in that statement is, if it was big enough, and it was significant enough, it would taint your whole salary. And over here we see that each barrel is worth a Pruta. And that means that even the Yayin Nesech here, when he moves that barrel, he gets a Pruta's worth, and that makes it significant. It's worth a Shavet Pruta here. And he says that's what taints the salary over here, even if you believe that there's Yesh Schirut Mitzchila Atzof, but because there's a disaggregated piece here that's worth a Shavet Pruta that is Asur, that taints the entire salary, and you can't disaggregate it, and it becomes problematic. And he bases that on the Gemara earlier that says it was okay because it wasn't a Shavet Pruta. Implied in what the Rashba says is, if the value of what you did is less than a Shavet Pruta, it would be mutar, even over here, with the moving of the barrels. So that's number one. The second thing is, the Tute Erev is not necessarily a time period. The way that Rashi and the Baliyat Tosafot learn it, it's at the end of the day, because he's finished his work, and then he does something that's extra or gratis at the end of the day. On the other hand, truthfully, you could look at it as the Tute Erev, it's just when he finishes the work that he's hired for. It doesn't necessarily have to be in the evening, they're just giving you the case that is normal. But even in the daytime, if he finishes work at noon, and then he asks him to add in something else, you'd be in the same boat. The Tute Erev is just an example of someone who's completed the work that they were hired for, and then they're adding on something afterwards. And that could be true in the daytime as well. They just leaves with Tuterev because that's your standard time when the work or the labor has finished that which he was engaged in. So this is the next part of the Mishnah. If he hires him as a donkey to try to move his Yayin Nesach, it's also problematic. Now, the Gemara's question basically is, what's this different than a Poel? Why would you think that the donkey driver should have anything different than the Poel? If you earn your money through Yayin Nesach, it should be problematic. Hatu Lomali. What do I need this extra piece for? Hainu Reisha. That's the same as the Poel and the Reisha. Seifait Strichale. Sachra Leshev Aleha. If he hired him to sit on the donkey, meaning that he wants to ride the donkey, and the donkey driver is going to take him. So instead of hauling stuff, the haul is the person themselves. Even though he puts his flask or his canteen on the donkey, scharo mutar. In that case, his schar is mutar. That is the chiddush of that part of the Mishnah, which is that if you are moving yayin nesech, you have a problem. If you're moving the individual himself, and he brings along with him the provisions that he needs for the road, including his yayin nesech, that does not make your salary asur. Lememra de glagin lav dinuhu l'otvei. Sounds like that is not a right of a rider on a donkey to take his flask along with him, because otherwise you'd be charging for that. If you're charging for that, then the salary should be problematic. Beremini, don't we have in the Gemara in Bava Metzia, it lays out for us the rules of donkey drivers. A socher tachamor, someone who hires a donkey, socher miniach aleha, the renter has the right to place on the donkey, ksuto. So over here, argues in the Gemara's ksuto, which is his clothing. If you look in the Balei Tosafot, they quote from the Rabbeinu Tam, in the Gemara in Bava Metzia, it's actually in the name of the Rabbeinu Chananel, which is that the girsa here should not be kisuto, but rather kasato from Lashon Keset, which means a small pillow that he sits on or that he rides on. Rabbeinu Tam spends time proving that the keset means a pillow and a kar means a mattress, even though some people, he says, say just the opposite, that a kar is a pillow and a keset is a mattress. He says a keset is a small pillow, and that's what he thinks over here, because he says, what do you mean he can take his clothes? You think he's going naked on the donkey? Of course he can take his clothes on the donkey. That's no chiddush. The answer probably is that it's a change of clothes. It's not the clothes that he's wearing, and that's how the other Rishonim explain it. Oleginato, and this is the problem they're going to have, he has a right to bring his canteen. He has a right to bring his wine with him. Umizonotav shaloto derech. And any provisions he needs for the entire trip. Let's say the trip is a 3-4 day trip. He can bring provisions for the entirety of that time period. Mikan ve'elech, anything more than that, chamar me'akev alav. The donkey driver can say, that's too much. You can't put it on there. You didn't pay for this. Chamar me'niach alav. The donkey driver himself is allowed to put on the donkey. Se'orim ve'tevin u'mizonotav shel oto ayom. He's allowed to put on the feed for the animal for that day, as well as his food for that day. Mikan ve'elech, more than that, socher me'akev alav. The renter can say, that's too much. You only have a right to put that amount on. The Gemara in a second will deal with the difference between their rights over here. But in the meantime, so over here, the problem that we have is that he has a right to bring his Yayin Nesach on the donkey. He has a right to bring his Yayin Nesach on the donkey. That means he's paying you when he rents the donkey for that right. And he's paying you for that right. You're earning your salary from carrying him and his canteen that's full of Yayin Nesach. And that should be problematic. So Rabbi Nehid Lagin Dinahu Lotive Mio Ilo Motive. Me, I'm reading le nechele agra de leginato. A very important principle. It's true today of passengers that fly on an airplane. When you fly on an airplane, you have a right to bring your carry-on bag, and you have a right to bring a piece of luggage on the plane. So, if you exercise that right, you don't pay any more because that's a right that's granted to you. But, if you fly without a carry-on, or you fly without your luggage, they don't discount the price for you. You don't get to pay less because you're not bringing your luggage. And similarly over here, when you hire the donkey, you have a right to put your canteen or flask on it. But if you don't bring your canteen or flask, you're not going to get a lower rate for renting the donkey. It's not considered to be a part and parcel of the salary. There's no monetary value assigned to that right. It's part and parcel of the totality of when you come, you have a right to bring it. But there's no monetary value to that because if you take it off, you're not going to get any discount or rebate for that. And because of that, it's not considered as if your salary is connected specifically to the ginato, but rather it's connected to his riding on the donkey. Echidami. So now the Gemara goes back to try to understand the situation in the Mishnah above Metzia. It's not relevant to our Gemara at all, but it just wants to understand why the donkey driver and the rider have different rights. So he says, Idish Chiach Lemizban, So if there is many pit stops along the way where it's easily attainable to get whatever you need, kamar nami lakape, then what the donkey driver should say to the guy that he's taking, listen, you can buy the provisions over there. Why are you taking the provisions from here? You can easily get it along the way with stopping in major cities. You have easy access to food and whatever you need or services that you need. Why should you have to carry it? If they're going like through the desert, they're going to a place where there is no pit stops and they can't get the stuff easily, then why can't the rider stop the donkey driver from bringing provisions for his donkey? Where exactly is he going to get the provisions if he can't put them on the donkey? So the question is, why is there an inequity between what rights the socher has and what rights the chamar has? Given these two scenarios, it seems to be that they should have equal rights. So the case is a case where you can, with a little difficulty or a little undertaking, after every day's journey, you could access the ability to find supplies and food that you need. It's not readily accessible, but it is accessible. So in that case, chamar, when it comes to the donkey driver, darche le mitrach le mizban, it's his obligation to go and undertake that effort in order to get the provisions. Now you can read darche as orach, which means it's normal, both from the perspective that he does this a lot, and so he knows where all the stores are, he knows where all the pit stops are that he can get what he needs, he is well versed in this traveling and in the places that he can get what he needs. That's number one. And number two is the fact that he is the donkey driver, in some senses, obligates him to do this because he hired out his donkey. The donkey is not for his use anymore. It's for the use of the socher. So he has to limit his use of the donkey. Socher, on the other hand, the renter, lav darkei lemitrach ulemizban. He doesn't make that undertaking. That could be from two perspectives. One perspective is he doesn't travel all the time, so he doesn't know all the places to go and where he can get what he needs. And number two is he hired the donkey. And as him, as the hiring of the donkey, means that he has greater rights on the donkey in this type of scenario. So that's why there is an inequality or an inequity in what they can place on the donkey. And that's because we obligate the donkey driver to do more. Plus, the donkey driver in general will do more because he's more familiar with the route. And for that reason, he can put on the supplies for daily supplies on there. Whereas the socher can put on the entire trip's supplies on the donkey. Now, Avua de Rav Acha Brei de Rav Ika. So the father of Rav Acha, the son of Rav Ika, which in essence means Rav Ika. So obviously the Gemara phrased it in this way because Rav Acha Brei de Rav Ika must have been more famous or more well known. And for that reason, they said that there was this story about the father, Rav Acha Brei de Rav Ika, which means it's a story by Rav Ika. Havashavik lu chamra the Ovdei Kochavim. He used to pour the wine for the Ovdei Kochavim. Vazel ma'aver lehu mi'abra, and he also used to help them cross the river. V'yabulei gufei ba'agra, and they used to give him the barrels as compensation for that. So the normal process was that when a person buys the wine, not only do they get the wine, they also get the barrel or the container that the wine is in. As they buy today a wine bottle, you get the bottle along with the wine. You're entitled to that bottle. Or if you bought it by the barrel, you would be entitled to the barrel itself when you buy the wine. So here, they were giving him the barrels as compensation, which means that they were paying him for his services, the additional services he was providing. The services that he provided are, number one, he used to fill their canteens. They had these canteens or these leather pouches that they used to carry the wine in, and he used to pour from the barrel into it, so that was one service he was providing. The second service he was providing is that they have to traverse a river, and he used to give them that ride for free. So he used to get the ride for free, plus he poured the wine into their flasks or into their canteens, and for that, they gave him back the barrels as compensation for the fact that he was providing them these extra services. Atu Amrulei Le'abaye. So someone went to tell Abaye that this was what Rav Ika was doing. Amrulei Ki Katarach Behetera Katarach. Baya says there's no problem with Rav Ika's doing, because when he is working with these individuals, he's working with Yetera. He's working with something that is mutar, which is that when he's pouring it into the canteen or into the flask, it doesn't become, the way Rashi phrases it over here, it does not become yayin nesech or stam yenam until it hits the base of the pouch. So when he's pouring it, at that point in time, that's the service he's providing. Once the wine hits the base of the canteen, that's when it becomes a sur. But that's already after he's already poured it into the canteen. So given that, there's no isur over here because of the fact that he's providing the service of pouring. That happens before the wine becomes a sur, and therefore salary is not associated with the isur. So Ravika taking his wine that's in his barrels, selling it to them, which means now they own the wine and the barrels. It's not Stam Yenam yet because they haven't touched it, they haven't engaged with it. But then he, as a favor for them, pours it into their flasks. So that's what the people were worried about. Here he's pouring it in, it's becoming Stam Yenam or Yain Nesech. How could Ravika take compensation for that, or how can he earn something for that? So Bai's answer is that it doesn't become a sur until it hits the base of the canteen. The service he's providing is the pouring. That happens before it hits the base of the canteen, and that's why it's mutar. Now, the Balei Tosafot are bothered by that, which is, first of all, once it hits the base of the canteen, it becomes a sur, then you have a nitzok. Then you have a flow of wine that goes straight from the barrel all the way down to the bottom. Doesn't that create a problem of connection? That's number one. And number two is that there are other Rishonim who note that who says that there's not wine at the bottom of the canteens? Forget about that. You're pouring into a canteen. If there's wine at the bottom, then it's mixing together with that wine. And again, you should have a problem of nitzok. So the Balei Tosafot reference you to the end of the Masechta on Daf Ayin Bet, where they say we're going to speak about nitzok. We'll do the same thing. We'll wait till there. But the basic view, and this is based on the Rabbeinu Tam, that when you have a nitzok, that can be stopped at any time. The Rabbeinu Tam thinks that that's not a connection that brings whatever is down below to that which is above. And therefore, the nitzok is not a problem. But this is one of their proofs, that a nitzok is not a problem, because here he's pouring it, and it's not problematic, even though the wine at the bottom of the canteen is problematic. They say, wait a minute. Baharot said b'kiyumo. Does he want these items to stay intact? D'lo nitztaru zike. So that the canteens don't burst. If these canteens or these leather flasks were to burst, then that would cause them a huge problem because they would then need the barrels in order to put the wine in. That means that he wants the wine to stay intact the way it is right now, because otherwise he's going to lose his salary of getting the barrels back. Because if they burst, they're going to have to put it into the barrels. So he wants the wine to be in place. And we said before, if you want the kiyum of the nisach hayayin, it's not in a destructive way, then that's a problem. And your salary would then also be problematic. Here, Ravika wants these flasks to stay intact. Either you have to say that the problem here is that the flasks themselves have absorbed from the yayin, and his wanting the flasks to stay intact are problematic, or he wants the yayin to stay where it is, or to be okay, because if the yayin's not okay where it is, it's going to end up in his barrels, and then he's going to lose the barrels. Mar says, the matnei behadayu. He has a deal with them. That even if they're flasks first, they're not taking the barrels back, meaning he gets the barrels irrespective of what happens. And then it's not Rotsevi Kiyumo. Inami Demaite Pristiki Bidahadayu. Or they bring back up barrels or back up utensils that they use. And here you can see in the Balei Tosafot, the Rabbeinu Chananel says Pristike are Klei Cheres Kadim Rekim. They're bringing empty pitchers to exactly this eventuality, that if something went wrong, they have backup kelim, and therefore he doesn't need the kiyumo. If they burst, they're going to take care of themselves. They're still going to leave the barrels with Ravika. And as Rashi points out, just so you know it over here, zike shel or, that when the Gemara uses the term zike, it means a canteen or some sort of flask that's made out of leather. Gulfe, it speaks about barrels or containers, those are shel cheres, those are earthenware. So they're giving him back the earthenware utensils that the wine was stored in, which was the way they stored in their day. Those were the barrels of their day. And he is pouring that wine into their zike, into their leather flasks. And his wine that is in his barrels, he's pouring into their flasks. And once he does that, they pay him for that service by returning him the barrel. Even though they own it, they purchased his wine and the barrels. Nevertheless, they give him back the barrels as compensation. The Katarach Visura. Wait a minute, isn't he also providing a service by crossing them over the river? And when he crosses them over the river, he's also moving their Yayin Nesach. It's the same thing as like a Chamor. Where you take the Chamor, you put the Yayin Nesach on the back, that salary should be Asur. So why is it Mutar over here? Damale Nimivraya Mi'ikara. He speaks to the ferry drivers beforehand. Inami Deniki Tebe Kitre. Where he has a special knot or seal on his items. So Rashi over here describes it in one of two ways. He says that Rav Ika Reishna Rahava. Rav Ika was the head of the river. Now this was a position both in the Roman government and in the Persian government, which is that if you're Reishna Hara, means that you take care of the river in that area, but that also means that you're entitled to collect the taxes and other tolls along that river. You're responsible for the river, but that responsibility also comes with benefits of collections that you can make on the river. So what he says is that he was the head of the Nahar, and he said to the ferry drivers, I'm negotiating with you up front that you'll take anybody who I send, you're going to take them across for free. So now in that way, he's not directly involved with the crossing of the river. He's not providing that service right now to them to move across the river. He's just saying, any customer that comes from me, you're going to take across the river for free. Sometimes it turns out that it was Yai Nesek, but first of all, he was not directly involved with it. He's not carrying it across. He's not ferrying it across. And number two is that the deal is a more aggregated deal by which it's anybody who comes. It's not specifically associated with this Yai Nesek, even though technically he is earning a salary from it, but he's not doing it himself or with his own possession, and therefore it is mutar. That's the first way that Rashi explains it. And Kitre, Rashi explains over here, is that he had a seal. And anybody who showed up came with a bag from Rebecca's store, then the ferry drivers knew, let them across for free. This siman, that you should know, ferry drivers, that when they show up with my bag, they're allowed to cross for free. In either way, he's not directly involved with the actual crossing of the river, and therefore the salary that he's earned is not associated with the Isura, either because it was pre-negotiated, or because it's done by other people. Both of those make it that it's not salary from Isur. In addition, there are Rishonim at the Raivet that suggest that they got a discount on the crossing. It wasn't that Rav Ika himself was crossing over giving it for free. Rav Ika was an important person, maybe even the Reish Nahara, according to Rashi says. And therefore, when he came down to the dock, the ferry drivers, if they saw people with him, would give them a discount because of his status or significance. So in that way, he benefited them, but he's not doing anything. He's not actually helping them across. All he's doing is getting them the discount. And in getting them the discount, that is what he was getting compensated for, and that wasn't something of Isur. Right now, the next Mishnah. Yai Nesek Shnafala Gabe Anavim. If Yai Nesek that fell onto grapes, Yedicham Vein Mutarot. All you have to do is rinse them off, and everything's fine. Now, the assumption here, the Bali Tosavot, note this, and it's brought from the Yerushalmi, which is that the anavim here, the grapes here, are still in their bunches and still attached to the stem. Because if you pull out the stem from the grape, then you leave a hole over there, and then it's as if the grape is open, which we'll see is problematic in the next part of the Mishnah. So the assumption here is the grape is sealed, and it's still attached to the stem, so there's no place for the wine to go into the grape. That means if you have the wine spill them, if you rinse them off, you've cleared away the yayin nesach, and there's no problem. Bimayu mevuka ot. If they were split open, asurot, because then the wine can enter into the grape, and then rinsing them is not going to be sufficient. Nafal agav te'enim o agave te'marim. If the wine was spilled on figs or dates, im yesh ben benotein tam asur. If they have enough to flavor the dates or the figs, it's problematic. Now, the assumption being here is that figs and dates, by definition, when they ripen, also split open. And given that, the problem here is now that the wine enters into the fruit, and so rinsing them is not going to be sufficient. So now the test is no tintam. Do they flavor them or do they not flavor? If they flavor them, you have a problem. If they don't flavor them, then it'll be fine. Umayse bebaitis benzonin. You have an incident with this individual. Shevi grugerot visfina. He brought dried figs in a boat. Nishtabra chavicha yayin nesech. Nafala gabehem. And on that boat happened to be a barrel of Yayin Nesek. It's interesting because was he really shipping Yayin Nesek? Then you have the problem with other Mishnah, which is that he's making money from shipping Yayin Nesek. What you have to say is one of the people on the ship with him brought their Yayin Nesek with them, but it wasn't that he was getting paid to transport the Yayin Nesek. It split open and it fell. It spilled over all these dried figs. He asked the Chachamim and they were matirit. Ma'atos would spend time on the Girsa here in the Mishnah. They were a different Girsa than the Mishnah. The way our Girsa has it, it comes after the point of the Mishnah where it says that dates and figs are problematic because they split open. And then if you got the Grugero, dried dates, alachat kama v'kama, that they would split open because you intentionally split them open. In order to dry them, they used to slit them so that the waters could evaporate and it could dry out the figs. So certainly over there, they're split open, and here you have we're going to see in the Gemara an incident where, when it came to the case law, they passed in what seemingly is against the Mishnah. On the other hand, the Bali Tosfot do bring another reading over here, which is that the case of Masav and Baitus Ben Zonon was brought right after the grapes in the Mishnah. The Gemara is going to then compare it to the case of the grapes that were split, that's problematic. And then over here, Grugorot are also split. How can you say it's mutar by the case when the Mishnah states explicitly that it is a sur with the broken grapes? This is the general principle. Kol shebehanato b'dotein tam, a sur. If there is a beneficial addition by this item, it gives flavor that is beneficial, it's problematic. Kol shebein b'dotein tam. If you have no tain tam, but it's a negative flavor that's imparted, or what's otherwise known as no tain tam lifgam, which is a negative flavor, mutar, then even if it does flavor it, but it's detrimental, then it's mutar. And an example of that is kion chometz, shnafala gabe grisin. If you have vinegar that falls on the legumes. So over there, the chometz has a problem possibly of coming from yain nesech, and that would make it asur, but and it flavors the legumes, but it's a negative flavor. It actually ruined the legumes. So there, even benotein tam, it's not a sur because it's notein tam lif gam. And that will be the discussion of tomorrow's daf, which is about notein tam, the basics of isur v'heter. We're going to discuss on tomorrow's daf. Today's daf is going to deal with the first half of the Mishnah, which is maaseh l'shtor. How come they brought this incident with baitus ben zonin, which is the exact opposite, as we noted, in the Pesach of the Mishnah, depending where it's placed in the Mishnah. It's either the opposite of the broken grapes, or by the dates and figs, we said they were asurim, and then you bring me a case of Grugorot and saying they are mutarim. Where it says, asurim extra, the Mishnah is actually missing some words in it. Rahiktani, im no tein tam lifgam hu mutar. If it imparts a negative flavor, then it's mutar. Maisenari vaitus bin zonin, shaya mevi Grugorot bisfina, he was shipping dried figs, and then a barrel of Yain Nesech burst on the boat, and then spilled all over them. And then the Chachamim went ahead and they were matir it. What the Gemara is basically saying is that the case of Baitus Ben Zonin is really connected to the latter half of the Mishnah, not the first half of the Mishnah. Which is that the first half of the Mishnah says when you have flavor, you have a problem. Then the second half of the Mishnah says, well, if it's notein tam l'shvach, it's not okay. If it's notein tam l'fgam, it's okay. And what they're saying is the case of Maitis Ben Zonin is a case like that. Although as the Bali Tosafot say that the language of Chasurei Mechzar is not really the right way to frame it. But rather it should have said, Bamed Dvarim Amurim. When is it true that figs and dates are problematic when they are cracked? Because they are naturally cracked. That's when it's Notein Tam Lishvach. But it's Notein Tam Lifgam, it's not. The Bali Tosafot say that the language of the Gemara is a little strange here of saying Chasurei Mechzar rather than Bamed Dvarim Amurim. How kri the chite? It was this pile of wheat. The Nafal Alei Chavita the Yain Nesech. A barrel of Yain Nesech spilled all over them. Sharia Rava Lizvune. Rava permitted the owner of the pile of wheat to sell it off to Obdei Kochavim, to non-Jews. The reason why Rava allowed him to sell it, even though we're dealing here with Yain Nesech that was spilled onto it, should be Asur Ba'ana'ah. It's either because it was Balua, it was already absorbed into the item so it wasn't visible. That's why he allowed him to sell it off, even though there was Yain Nesech that was involved here. Or, the fact is that Yain Nesech is not Osir Ba'ana'ah when it's Enu Mino, when it's in Tarovet, we don't make it completely Asur. Or, it's a possibility that we're speaking about Stam Yenam here. Again, the Gemara conflates the terms of Yain Nesech and Stam Yenam. It's possible that we're speaking about Stam Yenam over here, which would make it only then an Isur Derabanan. And then Rova's Psak was to sell it X, the value of the Yain Nesech that was there, or X, the value of whatever you thought was problematic. And that's why he allowed him to sell it. The problem, then, is the problem from Kilayim. How do you know he's not going to resell it? It's not visible, and therefore he might resell it, and that's the problem here, not the problem of the Yain Nesech itself. Etve Rabba Bar Levi the Rabba. So Rabba Bar Levi challenged Rabba's Psak over here and says, how could you do that? Why are you allowed to sell off this Chita to the Obdei Kochavim? Rabba Bar Levi challenges Rabba and says, Begich Avad Bo Kilayim. If you have a piece of clothing in which there was a string that was a problem of Kilayim, but it's no longer identifiable. You're not allowed to sell it to a non-Jew. You may not make it into a throw or a saddle for the donkey. What you're allowed to do with it is make it into tachrichim, for a mate. Lo mekochami my time alo. Why can you not sell it to a non-Jew? Dilma atel is one of these sell, because he might resell it to a Jew. In this case, the kilayim is not clearly identifiable in the beget. That means a Jew might end up with this beget. Or, if you make it into a saddle for the donkey, or a throw for the donkey, what might happen is the guy will get a hole in his clothing, and he'll cut a piece of the mardat off to use as a patch. But unbeknownst to him, it has kilayim in it. So the problem here is that it's unidentifiable by all the kilayim. The Bali Tosafot make note of that, that if you know for sure that there is kilayim, it's easily identifiable, then you can sell it to the non-Jew. And you can make it into mardat, because then the Jew who buys from him will be on alert. He knows there's kilayim in here, it's not a problem. Problem here is avad. It was lost in there, and that's what the problem is. Given that, you're not allowed to sell it to the goy, you're not allowed to use it as a mardat. What you are allowed to do is use it for a maid mitzvah. Because when you make it into shrouds for the maid, those are asur bahana'ah. So it doesn't matter whether he's buried in them or not buried in them. Once you clothe the maid in them, they now become asur bahana'ah. And then you don't have any worry of anybody else using them besides the mate himself. Achanami atelis one of Israel. In our case as well, maybe he's going to resell the chita to a Jew. Hadar shara. So then Rovar actually retracted his psak, and he now entered a new psak in the case. Now, as the Bali Tosafot will point out, this is not the first time that Rovar was corrected by Rabba Bar Levi, and therefore the Bali Tosafot would say that these two cases again were together. And Rabba Bar Levi only caught him once in the problem, and Rovar rectified it, because he's unwilling to say that Rovar made a mistake twice, or two different mistakes. He wants to consolidate the number of mistakes that Rovar makes, because Rovar in general was known as a huge posek, and almost all the way through Shas, the halacha is like Rovar. And for that reason, he wants to limit the number of times that Rovar makes a mistake. Shari lemitchinu, you can mill them, ulemefinu, and then bake them, and then you can sell them to a non-Jew as long as there's no Jew present when you sell them. So first of all, this is in a place where they are still makbid on pat akum, and therefore they're not going to buy bread from the non-Jew. Or you can argue it's a private non-Jew and they're not going to buy it from him, because pat falter is what they was allowed, not the pat of an individual. And so over here, they're not going to buy it from a goy. Elohim Cain, they see that a Jew sold it to the goy. They see that a Jew sold it to the goy, they know it's Jewish bread, and then they might come and buy it from the Ovid Kochavim. So you can sell it to the Ovid Kochavim as long as it's not in front of a Jew. And that way you won't have a problem of him reselling it to a Jew, and that the Yayanes that got mixed with this Kita is no longer an issue. Now, the Bali and Tosafot deal with a number of issues over here. The first of which is, why don't we say Batel Berov? You have Kilayim mixed into a baguette that has a single string in it. Why isn't it Batel there? That's what should happen. That single string should be batel to the other part. The Tosafot explain a principle over here, which is kilayim is an isur that is comprised of two pieces of heter, which is it's made up of wool, which is totally mutar, and linen that is totally mutar. Only when they are mixed together do they become a problem. And therefore, you can't say that when they're mixed together, they're going to be batel berov, because by definition, the mixture is what makes them asur. And so given that the definition of the Isur is a mixture, the mixture can't be what makes them mutar. You can't have batel berov over here. So Bali Tosafot say, is that really true? Don't you have basar v'chalav? By basar v'chalav, the basar alone is mutar. The chalav alone is mutar. But if you mix them together, you end up with an Isur. Based on the principle we just established, then basar and chalav should never be batel one and the other. Yet, Tosafot later on in the Masechta will spend a lot more time on this and prove this point, but that is that basar is batel b'chalav. If you have 60 times chalav up to the meat that falls in there, it's batel. And if you have 60 times the meat to the milk that fell in there, it's batel. So then my principle is broken down. Vaitos would say basar b'chalav is an exception to the rule, because it says, lo defashel gidi b'chalev imo, derech bishul asrat Torah. The Torah specifically states that the only Isur by basar v'chalav is when they are cooked together. And when you cook items together, you only put one item with the other item if it's going to flavor that item. You don't put in things to a dish that doesn't provide any flavor, doesn't provide any benefit. So if you have a little piece of milk that falls into a huge pot of basar, if the milk is not discernible, that's not the way you're going to cook. You're not going to add milk to it unless the milk brings flavor or brings something to the pot. And for that reason, the Torah says, derech bishul asrat Torah, Bazar Rechav is an exception. Even though it's two pieces of heter coming together to create a tarovet that's asur, that tarovet is only asur derech bishul. And the normal way to cook things is by flavoring. So if it doesn't provide flavor, it's not going to be asur. So that's how the Bayit Tosafot differentiate between kilayim and basar v'chalav. And as the Marav Mironshenberg points out, that the Bayit Tosafot in Chulin says the reason that we don't say it's batel over here is that it is batel midoraita, and this is only a takanat derabanan to worry about that kilayim that's mixed in, even though it is batel berov. So the Bayit Tosafot give a different answer in Chulin than the answer that they give over here. The other thing the Bayit Tosafot deal with here, and it's a very important principle, which is the problem of putting kilayim on the mate. If you put tachrikim on the mate that have kilayim, don't you run yourself into a problem of what's called loeg derosh. Loeg derosh is a principle that Gemara brings up with regards to meitim. We don't want to make fun of people. And that is because the pasuk says meitim chofshi, and that we learn from that that the meitim are chofshe min a mitzvot, that they are freed from mitzvot, they don't have any obligation to mitzvot. So if you do something in front of the mate that is indicative of doing a mitzvah, it's as if you're making fun of the mate, that he doesn't have this obligation, and you do have this obligation. And for that reason, the Gemara says that one shouldn't wear tzitzit when they go to the Beit HaKvarot, when they're within a moat of a kever, you shouldn't have your tzitzit hanging out or present, because it's as if you're making fun of them. We can do the mitzvah of tzitzit, you can't do the mitzvah of tzitzit. The Bayit Tosafot say, why isn't that true here as well? If you wrap the mate up in kilayim, then you're making fun of the mate. He's not chayiv in kilayim anymore. So therefore, you're wrapping him up in a beged of kilayim. How could you do that? Why isn't that a problem of loeg the rosh? So now the Bayit Tosafot say, v'yesh lomar, the shiny tzitzit. Tzitzit are different than any other mitzvah. Shehish kula k'neged kol ha-mitzvot. Because tzitzit represent all the mitzvot. Ve'ika loeg tvei. And that's much more making fun or maybe unintentionally affronting the mate because of the fact that your tzitzit represent that I can do all the mitzvot and you can't do the mitzvot. And so therefore he says it's uniquely associated with tzitzit versus it being associated with all mitzvot. And that's why by kilayim it's not a problem, whereas by tzitzit it is a problem. But then he also offers another alternative, that there is a machloket about whether latid davo you're going to be chayav in mitzvot. Between the Bei Rabbi Yana and Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan says mitzvot are betelot latid davo. The Bei Rabbi Yana says that mitzvot are still intact latid davo. Shmuel, subscribing to that position of Rabbi Yana, is the one who says that you can't do things that make fun of the mate or put the mate in a position where he's not keeping mitzvot. Whereas Rabbi Yochanan believes that you can do that because the meitim are not going to be chayav in mitzvot. So therefore, our Gemara over here who says that you can bury him in kilayim, that's Rabbi Yochanan who says that we don't worry about mitzvot latid avo. Shmuel, who holds like the Bei Rabbi Yanai, that there are mitzvot latid avo, says you can put him into tachrikum in kilayim, but you can't bury him in those kilayim, because latid avo, when he wakes up, he's going to be chayav in mitzvot. Says Ufize, achiluk necha, min hagenu. Shano meisirim et tzitzit, mitalitei ameitim. The Kaimel and Rabbi Yochanan, ulatamei, did lay mitzvot betelot. Based on that, the Bayit Tosafot would say, our minog makes sense, because we pass them like Rabbi Yochanan. If we pass them like Rabbi Yochanan, that means there aren't going to be mitzvot, latid davo. And that's why we bury people in four-cornered begadim without any tzitzit on there. We actually take off the tzitzit. We put them into a beged with tzitzit, and then we cut off the tzitzit from that beged, because we pass them like Rabbi Yochanan. He says, v'od smach lemin hagenu. There's another support for our practice from Masechet Smachot. And in Masechet Smachot, Abba Shaul tells his kids to take off the tchelet, to take off the tzitzit from his beged. And even though our Gemara seems to indicate otherwise that we bury the meitim b'tzitzit, and that's based on the Gemara that we saw in Bava Batra with Rabba Bar Bar Chana, the stories over there, when one of the Arab merchant takes him to see the meitim midbar, and when he finds the meitim midbar, they have tzitzit on. So that would be one proof, and we have other indications in the Gemara that they did wear tzitzit when they were buried. Nevertheless, the Bayit Tosafot point out that we have a number of practices that don't follow our Gemara, but rather follow the, what's called the Sfarim HaChitzonim, or the Masechtot Kitanot. It brings an example of that, is the laning that we have on certain days. We lane on the fast days, not what the Gemara Megillah says, which is Brachot VeKlalot, rather what it says in Masechet Smachot, Vayichal Moshe, and not Brachot VeKlalot. And other indications of that, for instance, which parshiot we read before Shavuot, which parashiyot we read before Rosh Hashanah, the Gemara Megillah gives one indication, and we don't follow that, and we follow again the practices of the Sfarim HaChitzonim. So Baal Tosfot said here, we have that in the Masechet Smachot, that suggests that you shouldn't bury with tzitzit. And then he brings from the Rabbeinu Yitzchak, read me Paris, Shayah Michalek, and he made a distinction. The Rishonim, in the earlier days, in the time of the Gemara, where everybody wore tzitzit, and they were zahir in the mitzvah of tzitzit, then they used to bury them with their tzitzit. Because when they buried them with tzitzit, it was like, this person who kept the mitzvot when he was alive, he also now is buried in tzitzit, an example of keeping the mitzvah. But today he says, where most people are not wearing tzitzit, and even those that wear it only wear it during davening, and you can find that in many of the Rishonim that are complaining. The Eben Ezra speaks about it, and others speak about it. I'll send you the Mikorot. They were not necessarily wearing tzitzit on a regular basis. The same problem that they have with tefillin, which is that once they got to this position where they say, we don't have a guf naki, we can't wear tefillin, then the practice became like what we have today, which is only to put on tefillin for davening for a short duration, because during that period we can keep a guf naki and that's it. We don't wear tefillin all day, unlike what they did in the time of the Gemara. So too, by tzitzit, the Eben Ezra says the same thing. People put on a talit just for davening, and afterwards they take it off, and that was it. They wore tzitzit the same amount of time they wore tefillin. That was for davening, and that was it. And the Eben Ezra complains about the fact that it doesn't make sense. The tzitzit are there to remind you of the other mitzvot, and to help you out, then it'd be better to wear them not during davening. During davening, nobody's going to sin. The problem is after davening, when you go out there, that's when you should be wearing the tzitzit. But based on that, he says that since people don't wear tzitzit, it would be a little bit of an affront or a joke if you bury them in tzitzit to say, oh yeah, he kept the mitzvah of tzitzit. What do you mean he kept them? He didn't wear them his whole lifetime. Now you're going to bury him in tzitzit? And in order not to embarrass those that do and those that don't, they don't bury anybody in tzitzit. So here the Baal Tosfot are trying to deal with this minhag of whether to bury with tzitzit or not bury with tzitzit. And they're describing a practice that many of the Rishonim discuss, which is that they used to not bury people in their tzitzit. They used to put them in a four-cornered baguette and then cut off the tzitzit, which is very interesting. You couldn't bury them without a four-cornered beggar at all, and not have tzitzit, and you wouldn't have the problem at all. Nevertheless, the practice was to put on the tzitzit, four-cornered beggar, and then posel to ruin the tzitzit, and that's still the practice in Chutz Laaretz still today, is to bury someone with a talit, and then they cut the tzitzit. Now, the practice then was they take off the tzitzit right before they buried them, to be posel the tzitzit at that point in time, and then bury them. We don't do that today. We today posel the tzitzit before we put them into the coffin, both likely because today we're burying in coffins, and therefore you have to do it beforehand, otherwise you'd have to open up the coffin to take off the tzitzit when you were burying them, as well as the fact that we just take care of it up front and posel the tzitzit, so there's no questions whether it was done or wasn't done. That is the practice in Chutz Laaretz. In Eretz Yisrael, they put on a talit on the individual, and right before they bury them, they take away the talit, they take off the talit before they bury them. So they don't put in a pasul talit. And that's the difference between what they do in Chutz Laaretz and in Eretz Yisrael. But both of them are following this practice that we don't bury with tzitzit. And that is based on the fact of loeg l'rosh, that we don't want the person to feel like we're making fun of them, that they're unable to keep the mitzvot. The Baal Tosfot say that that in itself is not sufficient, because over here you're allowed to bury with kilayim. So it's either because we pass them like Rabbi Yochanan, that they will not be mitzvot atid lavo, and therefore it's no problem of loeg l'rosh anyway, or based on what the Baal Tosfot is suggesting over here, that tzitzit are keneged kol mitzvot, and that's why there's more of a problem by tzitzit than by other mitzvot, or because people don't wear tzitzit anymore, since they don't wear tzitzit on a regular basis, we're not going to bury them in tzitzit, because that's what's making fun of the mate. The Oruch HaShulchan brings down that there were two gedolim that specifically said to their Talmidim that they wanted to be buried in tzitzit and not to pasul the tzitzit. And he says in both cases, something happened. He told one of his Talmidim, and then during the Tara, that Talmid had to step out for a second. And during the period of time that he stepped out for a second, they cut the tzitzit or they pasul the tzitzit. When he came back in, he started to scream. How could it be? He told me not to cut the tzitzit. We have to change it. The Gedolim there saw that as a siman min hashamayim, that they shouldn't change it, and they should leave it as pasul b'tzitzit. And the other story the Oruch HaShulchan brings is that also an individual said he wanted to bury his tzitzit. As they were lowering the mate into the kever, one of the tzitzit got caught and tore off. So they saw that as being a siman, that even though these gedolim wanted to be buried in tzitzit and think that's the ikar halacha, nevertheless, min hashamayim, they prevented them. And then the Oruch HaShulchan in the end says I'll tell you who these two people were. Says the Rishon was the Gro, who wanted to be buried, and the second was a Chassid, Maraz Yavradno, the author of the Sefer Yisod B'Shor Shavodah. He says both of them wanted to be buried in Tzitzit. Minishamayim, they stopped them. So even though there are those that tried to reintroduce the practice, or have they made him buried in Tzitzit, nevertheless, the practice today is still not to bury in Tzitzit. And even those that tried to change the minhag, they were not successful at changing it because Minashamayim, quote unquote, they intervened to stop it from happening. Both times they ended up with not having the Tzitzit on when they got buried. Now the principle of Loi Garosh applies today that one goes to the cemetery, they should be careful to put away their Tzitzit and not to walk around with their Tzitzit. You're also not allowed to daven or learn Torah within Arba Amot of the kever of someone. And that's all because of this principle of Loi Garosh, which is that it's making fun of the mate. But that implies that the meitim are aware of what's going around them. And that is based on the Gemara in Brachot that speaks about the fact that meitim are aware of what's going on around them, and then it brings a number of stories over there. For rationalists, like the Rambam, that's a very difficult thing to accept, that the meitim know what's going on. And therefore, if you look in the Rambam, anywhere the Gemara uses a psul of Loi Garosh, you're not allowed to learn, you're not allowed to daven, you're not allowed to say Kriyat Shema within the Arba Amot or the kever of a mate, all those are, the Gemara says, because of Loi Garosh. You're making fun of the mate. In each of those cases, my brother-in-law pointed out, the Rambam leaves out Loi Garosh. He brings a different reason for the problem. You're davening in a makom that's enu ra'oi for davening. You're learning in a place that's enu ra'oi for learning. And the Rabbi on the spot criticizes the Rambam. Says, what do you mean it's not ra'oi? It has nothing to do with not ra'oi. It has to do with the fact that it's Loi Garosh. But you see, what the Rambam did was, he, in his rationalist view, said it can't be that the Meitim understand. Meitim don't talk, they don't listen, they're not aware, and therefore the problem must be, it's a place that's inappropriate. And that's what he does, he converts the issue of Loi Garosh into a problem of Enu Ra'oi, which the Rabbit criticizes him for. Alright, just to finish up the Gemara over here, it says, Snan, Yain Esek Shnafala Gabi Anavim Yidichan. You have wine that falls on top of grapes, you rinse them off. Vein mutarot. Vein mivukaot, if they're split open, asurot. Mivukaot, and if they're split open, they are problematic. Shem mivukaot lo. They're not split open, they're not. So over here, in our case, by the wheat, why should there be a problem that the yain netzak fell on the wheat? The wheat kernels are whole. They're not split open. So Rav Papa says, shine chite hova gab tzirayu kemivukaot damyan. Because the way that the wheat kernels grow, they grow with natural fissures or natural cracks along them, and that's as if they're split open. By definition, it's as if they're split open, and therefore the Nayai Nesek can be absorbed in there, and that's why it is problematic. Okay, we're going to stop here at the bottom of Samachay Amud Bet.